friends, welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. And we're here in lovely, beautiful downtown Wallingford. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Mr. Chris Casso.
Hello.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
How's everybody this evening?
Just peachy.
Peachy. All right. Well, I'm peachy too. I'll tell you, it's still kind of cool here in Seattle, Washington. I mentioned this last week, and it's true again this week. It's nice and cool this evening. When this episode airs, who knows? Speaking of things that are hot, 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 Attack on Titan, I hear it's been selling 2 million copies. There's an article that Chris sent around that says that the industry really isn't paying attention to how well Attack on Titan's doing.
Mm-hmm. Or manga in general.
Yeah.
That's a lot of the comic sales sites that I look at. There's a few that will touch base on these things, but they don't have context because it's not in their wheelhouse. They just don't care about the manga scene. And American manga started to go downhill a couple years back. Like Tokyopop was one of the big distributors, and they fell apart. But Attack on Titan came back and came in, and it basically just hit the U.S. really, really hard, and people started getting into it. And it's huge in Japan, too, because when they hit some of the high sales numbers a little while back, they occupied, like, a city. And when I say they, I'm not entirely sure if it's the publisher or what. But, like, skyscrapers were getting pictures of the characters projected on them, and there were firework displays. So, like, everyone really cared about this comic book.
Is there not an amusement park as well?
There's an amusement park.
Which is
creepy.
Giant zombie creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they have no skin.
Right.
And the live-action movie is I don't know if it's out over there, but it.
I've seen the trailer for it.
Yeah, we've got the trailer.
For those
here.
Who don't know, what's the premise of the show? Because it's a little weird.
Yeah, so
Or manga, rather. What's the premise of the manga?
It's post-apocalyptic fantasy. So basically, these creatures came, like, now, basically, and they're these giant humanoids the size of buildings with, like, no genitalia. They're just these weird looking off. Their anatomy's kind of off too. Some of them are just weird looking, and they eat humans, and that's all they do. And no one knows why. So humanity is reduced to,
we're,
like,
tasty,
yeah, exactly,
and crunchy,
but
soft on the inside.
Ew. But so now all that's left of humanity after centuries is like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, and we're all inside this one city, and we're back to medieval lifetime. And there was a giant wall built to keep them out, and we haven't had to deal with them for a while. And then suddenly one day a titan the size of a skyscraper shows up, knocks down the wall, and we lose like a quarter of humanity that day. So the story follows like the rest of the struggle against these creatures as they still don't know anything about them. And there's anomalies, like there's the one the size of a skyscraper, a female titan that's actually smart and can strategize shows up, and there's one that's like an armor built one. So it's just really weird horror drama post-apocalyptic fantasy fiction.
Do we ever get to any truth of what these creatures are? I've watched the anime. I think I've read one of the books. And I see the fascination, but I can see answers to a lot of the mysteries of the story a long time coming, and at the time I didn't have the patience. Do we ever get to find out?
I made it through 15, volume 15, and not yet. And it kind of starts doing that Lost thing of like, oh, we answer a thing, here's five more questions. You know,
okay.
Yeah, you know. Like the last thing I read was there was a titan that was basically a giant Sasquatch who could speak. So she's like, okay, what?
Well, I was trying to get to the bottom of the fascination for you know, Asian culture, what's so fascinating about it, and what we're missing in, you know, the West, why we're not seeing it. And yet the book is selling so well, and...
Yeah.
Have you not read 50 Shades of Grey? I mean...
I have not read 50 Shades of Grey.
We have our bestsellers over here. It's not awesome, you know, a manga like Attack on Titan.
The entry point to this discussion was that...
The sales, right? So the thing is like... a lot of the focus on why this is weird that the U.S. markets don't talk about this is that they announced that there's over 200,000 copies of the first Star Wars trade to the new Marvel run pre-ordered. And that's a really big number for like a $20 trade. It's really cool. But that pales in comparison to the collection of all the different volumes, the circulation of Attack of Titan. So it's just really interesting why... Attack on Titan seems to be broadly accepted by the public, the Japanese public, but also by American public, you know, selling great at Barnes & Noble, but we still have this kind of niche system in the U.S.
I see.
Yeah, you know. Okay. There was another great book, one of Renee Taglemeier's book. Am I mispronouncing her name? Sisters, I think,
Sisters,
was the last one.
Yeah.
That hit like 200 or 250,000, mm-hmm. and that got a little bit of reporting, but at the same time, I feel like the industry kind of like, ah, and that happened.
There were no like parades for sibling.
Yeah, exactly.
Joy.
You know, there's just this the fact that this so popular in Japan that they overtook buildings to celebrate the print run. It's an amazing concept. Ooh, ooh. That's been embraced by the
Got
public.
Okay. So the print run is, I heard, 2 million. Is that
it right? Sounds right? But I'm a little confused as to what that is split among all the different volumes.
Okay.
Right.
Right. And those are over 15 volumes. But put it in context for me. What's considered a successful print run for, say, I mean, you said Star Wars was 200,000 and it was huge. Like if I picked up, you know, like Lock and Key or
right.
one of the Secret Wars books, you know, if one of those is considered successful, what's that number?
You know, I don't have any real numbers to play for you because also that's the difference between trade numbers and single issue numbers.
Okay.
You know, once you get, because I think like low numbers for single issues are like 5,000 to 10,000. And that's like, if you look at the top 300 sellers in the industry, like that's at the bottom of the list kind of stuff. So more than 25,000 is a little bit healthier. Once you're getting into 100,000 plus, you're kind of getting into a good average for healthy books,
okay.
I think. But again, I don't have numbers on me to play with that right now. Trade numbers, I imagine, are a little bit more truncated. You know, it's Lock and Key. I would be impressed if it was within the 25,000 to 50,000 numbers.
Okay.
But I could be totally wrong.
Cool. So that's I just completely lost my train of thought.
Cole, bail me out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm the thread jacker, dude. You have to set up the thread in order for me to bail you out.
I'm trying to think of the next thing I want to say.
Okay, do we want to do book report?
Things.
Do we want to do trivia time?
Do
you want Nicole and I to dance?
Oh, yeah, clean up that wet spot on the carpet there where you spilled your water.
Okay, that's going to be out of context, and that's going to be really upsetting to a lot of people.
Because everybody listens to this show
back to back
in
only
order.
The contrarian does that.
Yeah, no, I know some people who listen to anyway. If you
he
listen, email us at perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com. Tell me you listen. That's a strange plea for attention. I'm sorry I did that.
Well, just to go back to Attack on Titan.
Oh, now I remember what I was going to say.
It is thank you, Cole. It is a creepy, creepy property.
It's super creepy.
It is so creepy.
And I've watched the manga, the anime sporadically on
Netflix.
On Cartoon Network. Uh-huh. And it's got a serial formula story, and it's a little bit preposterous the way they rig their fight suits to jump on the backs of the creatures.
Yeah.
But I get the fascination, but I also find it kind of repelling because those creatures are just really, really scary to me.
Yeah.
But our culture is not into giant monsters. We're not into daikaiju the way Japanese and Asian cultures are. And it just seems like the perfect amalgam of the zombie fascination and kaiju and medieval and...
But I still don't see us doing like parades, you know. Like we're not celebratory like that.
But I had a question going back to that. I mean, is that a cultural celebration of a property, or is that just darn good marketing?
Probably a lot of darn good marketing.
I think it's just darn good.
But the fact that it was embraced is the part that's very interesting to me.
In a capitalist culture, we don't know how to do anything else.
When I was a kid.
Giants walk the earth.
Back to the Future played for a year straight at the local cinema.
Dude, seriously?
Yeah, 1 year straight. And to celebrate the year mark, they brought in Biff, the guy who played Biff, whose name I don't remember at the moment. He's a stand-up comedian. And they brought in two DeLoreans, and they had a big parade downtown Olympia with these DeLoreans and ending with, we thought it was going to be Christopher Lloyd or Michael Jackson.
Oh,
you can't imagine the disappointment everybody felt when Biff stepped out of the DeLorean. On a much smaller scale, it's a celebration of something.
I guess you got to say, America is so big, right? It's hard to compare it to other places that are on a much smaller scale. But I mean, something like that, I don't know if we wouldn't necessarily do like a nationwide thing, but maybe we'd do something in a big city, like, you know, Times Square would have Titans on it or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, manga, how do you pronounce that?
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I say manga.
What is the difference between manga and anime?
Oh, here we go. Explain to Bantine.
Manga is the book. Anime is the animation.
So that is the difference. That's kind of what I thought, but I didn't know if that was true.
I've heard there's been people arguing some of those details. I'm just like, let's just stick with that for now.
Well, so in manga, I always say manga because I think manga, someone coached me on it once. Yeah. So, but manga are usually black and white, inexpensively printed. Mm-hmm. Readable materials, but they were originally conceived for the Japanese salaryman to read on the train on the way to work.
And disposable.
And they are highly, they are, you know, far more.
Like comic books are American.
Like Golden Age comics.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Comic books are very much an American art form, but manga are very much a Japanese art form, unique to both those cultures. Because, they're not meant to be kept, and they mass produce them, and there would be like, you know, there's like, how many Batman books would you say DC produces a month?
At least six or seven.
You know, my understanding is that like if the character's popular, like Gogol 13 or somebody like that, there'll be 20 different books, and he'll be appearing in different anthologies and different collections and Shonen Jump this and that. So.
Wow. All right. So Attack on Titan. Is it worth reading? Is it that good?
I enjoyed it. The trick is that in the book, the drama between the characters starts to drag my interest out. Mm-hmm. It just really turns into these teenagers about like, oh.
But then before you know it, a Titan shows up and it's all better.
So it's
pretty much like wait for the Titans. That's what it should be called.
Wait for the Titans.
Waiting for Titans.
Waiting for Titans.
On Cartoon. Right.
Now, the interesting thing I will also say is that, the guy who draws it, his humans kind of suck as far as anatomy. He's got an interesting style, but so it works for the Titans because that sucky anatomy makes them look horrendous. So when you get to the cartoon, the humans look better because the animators are like, we got to actually make them clean them up. But they kept the horribly misanatomied creatures looking the same.
Was there not an X-Men or Avengers?
Oh, the free comic book day Avengers versus.
It was Avengers versus.
And then the Guardians of the Galaxy showed up singing a song from the movie. It was really weird.
It was. I did read that. It is really weird.
Yeah.
All right, we got to move on.
Okay, that's probably for the best. We're all going in here.
Now, Mark Waid and J.G. Jones released a title called Strange Fruit. Mm-hmm. And this week on the website womenwriteaboutcomics.com, one of their authors, J.A. Michelin, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, wrote basically a rebuttal towards the comic, saying that Waid and Jones, who are two white men, cannot possibly know what the black experience is like. This book is about Southern racists and an alien who presents himself as a like a strong, like brutish black man.
So let's,
he seems like a black Superman to me.
Yeah.
Can like you set up the Superman. Premise of the comic book, just sort of give an overview?
Yeah, so it's like 1927, I think, right. Mississippi, during like the Great Mississippi Flood.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they're dealing with the emergency of the immediate flooding, and a comet lands, and it's an alien spaceship, and it's got a strange visitor inside it. And there's a certain part of the book where the Klan, the KKK, is chasing a black man, and they come across the occupant of the ship, and he is a black man, and he beats up the KKK. And so that's the setup. It's what if a Superman landed in one of the most racially charged places and times in American history, and he was black. So what happens?
And the critic from the website, we kind of started with this. Our entry point into this discussion about this book was Nicole had posted it to our Perfect Bound podcast closed discussion group on Facebook. So, and I read her criticism of the comic book before I read the comic. And this is not usual for me. So my point of entry into this discussion is I read her criticism before I read the comic book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was the same way. So.
Okay, you did. Okay.
As did I. I read the comic today, and it, with the context of this article, mm-hmm. And I was trying to think about what would I have thought of this comic had I not read this article.
Right.
Had I not read this article first. I don't know who Mark Waid and J.A. Jones are. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And I'm very familiar with it.
Well, so, and my initial thing was like, oh, a black Superman. This is awesome. Like, this would be like freedom for the slaves. Or I don't know. Something for me was thinking about DC Superman and like him being a really good person. And,
yeah.
And that was like, oh, this is uplifting. This is empowering. And like, clearly that was not what she got out of the comic book.
Right.
So it was good to get the perspective and then to go in and read the comic.
But Chris, you read the book before
the
article came out.
So I read it first like 3 weeks ago, something like that. Mm. Article came out actually, I think almost 2 weeks ago. Maybe a week plus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then I went back and reread and then I reread and then I reread. I reread both things a number of times than other people's because I wanted to get as many different perspectives as I could.
Great.
I also unfortunately read all the commentary on a number of sites.
Oh, no, Dad, never do that. No.
Right, yeah, but and the problem with that is anonymity because I actually am starting, wanted to try and get a feel about how different types of people reacted. So that's the thing. When I first read it, I enjoyed it. On the reread with her notes in mind, there are definitely a lot of issues I understand mm-hmm. completely from her standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
There's parts of her arguments that get muddled for me as well, but I'm not going to get into that. What I think is the most important thing to get out of it is that we need more perspective in the industry. We
mm-hmm.
need more creators of different backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
ethnic, religious, everything. And just to understand, because, a couple podcasts back, Nicole mentioned that you had read something from a trans person talking about the representation of trans people in comics.
Yeah, and there were some subtleties there that you wouldn't have picked up if you weren't trans.
There's subtleties that you just don't know because you may not be in that scenario.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that I want to see the rest of the story because we're talking about issue 1 of 4. I think it was printed in the wrong format to begin with. And then I
think it should have been in a
graphic novel because then it would have been released at Barnes & Noble and then we would have had a larger grouping of people talking about it.
Because there's a little part of me that's hesitant to launch into a criticism, albeit constructive, of the book without having read the whole series.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm really curious to know what the rest of the story
like
is.
I got to tell you, I may wind up reading the whole series
to learn more. Well, because you said you were bored. It's like this was all set up.
Yeah.
So there's some mm-hmm. things that I find difficult to really attack because I know it's all set up.
Mm-hmm.
So
I
want
to mentions that too, where she was like, it could go different ways, but right now just with number one, this
but
is
there was
what
a takeaway.
Like.
I can't remember the other gentleman who'd written, it was a white fellow had written a follow-up that we, a piece that we also read. And, one of the things that I appreciated him acknowledging, I wish we had his name, but we don't, was an acknowledgement of comics are entering an era where we have an opportunity to recognize and celebrate diversity. We
mm-hmm.
don't have to listen to white versus reinterpreting or appropriating a voice when we can get it from the source and...
I believe that article is written by Rob Salkowitz.
Okay.
It's from like ICV2.
Okay.
So that is a good article, the check on that. And again, it's like it's worth reading a number of different sources
mm-hmm.
about this subject and to get as well read as you can before a judgment. Like try not to take a full judgment on from someone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a knee-jerk reaction and you don't actually have the initial context of what people are having an upset about or having criticism about.
But the more informed you are, the better. Always.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that is all over happening, of getting other people's perspectives in the world. And the comic book industry is no different. I mean, I've been talking about strong female protagonists. I mean, that's been a big movement for people, and people of color has been a big push as well. So, of course, anything that is, coming from that is going to be a little bit maybe more charged because it's readily on people's mind. Mm-hmm.
And I've said it before, that's why I'm very hopeful of them bringing back Milestone, because
mm-hmm.
I think the time is perfect for that publisher to experience a rebirth because that audience will be there. I truly believe that audience will be there for that publisher.
Yeah, I'd like to see. I would have been more interested if Milestone was coming on its own and not as part of DC,
mm-hmm.
but I'll be interested to see how they do it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So
I propose that we keep following Strange Fruit mm-hmm. and talk about it as it goes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, again, I read it today, and I read it online. Cole, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this, but Cole gave me his login creds for Comixology.
Because I'm that kind of guy, brother. I am that kind of guy.
I got to tell you, reading a comic like that where they write into the dialogue the accents on a 15-inch laptop monitor is not the best way to read a comic. It took me like 10 minutes to get through a page.
So you have to sound it out.
You had your experience with a digital comic.
Yeah, and
we talked about that before.
It was terrible, man.
I don't care for it. But, you know, honestly, you guys didn't have it in the shop, and I felt like we were at a crucial juncture there in the discussion. It's like, oh, heck with it. I'm going to compromise my principles and buy something from Comixology.
I appreciate you did, because it allowed me to read it at work. Sorry, yeah. Work. Yeah. But I was imagining how I would have felt if I had read it not knowing the context, and not even knowing Wade's and Jones's ethnic makeup.
Right.
I didn't think it was boring. I would have felt uncomfortable. Yeah. That's kind of what my feeling.
That was the point of the whole one. So yeah, they said they were prepping for that. So
okay,
yeah,
fair enough.
They didn't want anyone to feel comfortable. So
yeah,
to lighten the mood, I guess, or to have a teaching moment, as they often say. Mm-hmm. What are comics that are written from that perspective properly? Like, what are some good comics written by African Americans? What are some good comics written by Asian Americans that deal with the that worldview?
It is worth noting that there is another book called Strange Fruit that is actually written by an African American. Okay. Yes. You can get it on Amazon and check that out.
And it was linked, I think, in her article.
Yeah, it's linked in the article. Yeah. And we've talked about, I mean, I have a few favorites. I love Christopher Priest as a writer, mm-hmm. and he did an amazing run on Black Panther. Dwayne McDuffie is somebody that is worth backtracking and finding his work on and reading. He did pass away, unfortunately. But the Justice League animated cartoons, he was a key force behind those. And those are really great. Did you have any particulars?
I didn't really actually prep anything for this. I was just thinking of the Black Panther specifically, because I know you've always loved his writing, Christopher Priest's writing. Mm-hmm. And
he's going to be... Oh, man, I saw that he was coming back for a project, but I can't exactly remember what it is.
Quantum and Woody, was it?
The new one. There's another project coming up. No, not new Quantum and Woody, but there's another project, a completely different project. So, yeah. Right. Oh, I believe...
Was it a Valiant thing?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I just don't know right now.
I'm trying to help here.
Do we have any final thoughts on Wade and Jones's Strange Fruit?
Jones is a very gifted painter, illustrator, and
it's beautiful artwork.
Yeah.
And Wade has, in the past, been a writer that has challenged me with stuff like Irredeemable. But I had trouble with this, but it is only the first issue. So,
right.
But I do propose that we follow the story and talk about it as it goes.
All right. Maybe when the entire thing has been released, we'll revisit this as a topic. But until then, it's time for Book Report, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
A weekly series we do. And I'm going to go first this time. Because I read something that's completely opposite of Strange Fruit. I read The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl number one, the third printing, which I guess is important because they say it right on the front there. Squirrel Girl is kind of been a thing for me. Cole was always kind of making fun of me because of Squirrel Girl, because I wrote it into a script once, and he's like, "Oh, Ben likes Squirrel Girl." Now I'm like, I don't even know who this is. So I figured had to read number one, and I liked it. I was charmed by it. It's got these I don't want to call them subtitles. It's got really tiny, tiny print at the bottom of each page that's kind of a commentary on that page.
Yeah.
And
it's Ryan North style. He did that in the Adventure Time comics.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And I recommend. I mean, it's really interesting because they sexualize Squirrel Girl more than I thought they would.
Interesting.
Because she stuffs her tail into her pants and then talks about how banging her booty is.
Yeah.
But don't you do that in the privacy of your own home, Ben?
Well, moving on.
Let's say the reason I never read that, other than the joke of it, was there have been previous runs that really kind of sexualized her. Like Bendis did. They had an artist draw her a little bit sexier than normal, and they also hinted that her and Wolverine had an affair.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, and there's some weird moments where you're just like, this is getting kind of uncomfortable right now. So yeah, this wasn't sexualized right. to me because I had that.
Okay, I didn't have that context yes. with which to read it, but it's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to the next one. All right, and Nicole, what did you read?
I've been reading an older comic that's also a web comic called Strong Female Protagonist. They did actually do a Kickstarter and collect it into print form. Which also happened with, like, Nimona and stuff. But anyway, Strong Female Protagonist is dealing with a girl named Allison Green, who, as a teenager, was a superhero. She had superpowers, super strength. Can't really, you know, she was always taking down the bad guys. And the question throughout it is that, like, if you were a superhero and you found out, you know, once you found your greatest foe, that everything was actually, like, nothing that you did actually made a difference. You know, what would you do with your life after that? If like being a superhero, you're not actually the important superhero. We killed all of them. So you're not a threat to us. So you're not really going to do anything. You might as well just grow up and move on. And that's the whole premise of the book, where she comes from. And so she takes off her mask and she goes to college, 'cause that's what you do. And get into, you know, student loan debt and stuff. And then other people from her past are coming in, and it's just dealing with these sort of interpersonal things. Also acknowledging that as a superhero, she had a totally different life. She didn't have a teenage life. And so, you know, what does it look like to be kind of normal too, you know? So it's been very interesting. They also do, so it's Brennan Mulligan who writes it, and Molly Ostertag, who has done some variant covers for Boom, but hasn't really necessarily been main published yet, as far as a comic book is concerned, and I guess this one, because this is published. But okay, anyway, they also do the little commentary like Ryan North does, yeah. But it's, Ryan North is the best. He's just snappy. I don't know. Anyway, I would definitely recommend Strong Female Protagonist. It's not something we have in the store right now, but it's something that we try to get back in when we can. But it is something you can read online, and definitely recommend it. I don't know if it could be considered a deconstruction of a superhero. Oh,
don't worry about that. Don't worry about
that. I'm not entirely sure. But it is a new spin on superherodom and the world, and what does it look like to change the world? Who can call themselves a hero? Like, it's really playing into some of that. You know, when you just think of, I'm super, I can punch you through a wall. And then, well, who are the casualties because you punch that person through a wall? You know, so it goes through all those different levels. And it's really interesting.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Chris, what about you?
I read Power Up, which is a new Boom comic by Kate Leth and Matt Cummings. And it's a lot of fun. It follows this young girl named Amy who works at a pet store called the Rat's Nest, I think. Cool. And one day, like these strange rays of light hit her and a goldfish that she was next to. And then she's like, oh, well, I guess we're okay. And then this really creepy, weird alien in a suit shows up and tries to do something, maybe kill her. And it turns out that she has powers, and so does the goldfish. The goldfish, who's very derpy, transforms into a magical whale and saves the day, and then he turns back to a goldfish. And it's great art. It's a lot of fun. It turns out there were other people that were hit by the ray of light, so it's just like this team. What's great is that one of them looks like this kind of burly construction worker guy who gets like a Sailor Moon suit,
which is so awesome.
He looks pretty awesome. And so it's a lot of fun. It's really cute. And for the first issue, it was pretty awesome.
And cool. Kate Leth is the founder of the Valkyries.
Ah,
so she's been writing Bravest Warriors, Edward Scissorhands, and now she's doing Power Up.
Mm-hmm.
So
cool.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Cole Hornaday, what about you?
Well, I read the latest graphic novel installment, or trade, rather, installment of Invincible. This one's called Modern Family. And I wanted to go back to the one issue that Nicole brought up about the previous collection, and I can't remember the name.
It's 110. Number 110 is the
Well, the previous volume was number 20. I'm talking about the trade collections.
Oh, okay.
And you're talking about. And so the previous one was called Friends. Yeah. So in the earlier issue, the protagonist Mark is actually raped by a woman.
Yes.
Anissa.
Sure.
Anissa. Mm-hmm. Anissa is her name. And what was interesting is that Nicole brought that up, and I had just sort of glossed over that in the story because I think I was reading it from a different perspective, and I forgot about that. And that issue comes up because Mark. In this story, there's a lot going on in five issues. There's all kinds of punch 'em ups. There's aliens. Mark elects to take he and his fiance and their newborn daughter off planet and go move to another world, in part to get away from the stragglers of his race. I can't remember what they're called. The Viltrumites. That are all supermen. You know, and bent on universal domination, which I believe was one of the motivating factors of this gal raping him, was that they need to replenish their race.
Yeah.
But also, it was just, you know, it was also a rape scene. So he's dealing with the emotional ramifications, repercussions of this, and not being able to be intimate with his girlfriend, be emotionally available to his newborn daughter. And I'm reading this going, you know, there have been so many times where men have tried to tell this story and failed because they can't tell this story because they don't know what it's about. Mm. And I'm afraid this may be, once again, another one of those times where maybe you shouldn't go there because you don't know how to talk toward, you don't know how to talk about being sexually assaulted in your story. And I'm not sure why it's there other than to create emotional conflict.
It
knotted me up.
Well, it depends, because some writers actually will do research. They will talk to people.
Sure.
They will do that kind of thing. So I don't know what the case is here, but...
Yeah, and I mean...
Did you read this one? Have you read this, Chris?
I read that one issue, but I've been behind by like about 3 years worth of stories.
All right.
Kirkman's—he's formulaic to me, and I don't.
It is terribly formulaic, but I'm caught up on the formula because I do like the characters, and I think Ryan Ottley's artwork is terrific, and I have a good time with it. And he's got a—he paces his stories very quickly, and he's got a witty turn of phrase, and I find his characters to be charming, but it is very formulaic. Ben, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say I'm one to give the artist the benefit of the doubt if they're doing a scene about something. I'm not going to say they don't have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know.
Right.
But the writer talking about something later, because you said artist, didn't you?
I'm sorry. I meant writer.
Oh,
the creator.
Okay.
Yeah, the
okay.
creator.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, anything else you want to say on what is that? Invincible?
Invincible. Trade paperback number 21. I'm enjoying it, but I...
Would you recommend it?
Only because I'd like to talk with other people about their response to this, their reaction to this part of the story.
All right, so if you're a friend of Cole's, come to the Comic Extension and buy Invincible and read it so Cole can have a conversation. And that's our show. But before we go, of course, we play quiz time. And again, I've outsourced the questions for this quiz time. Who wants to have their questions?
You ready to go? Nicole?
All right, so questions this week. The questions this week come from Nicole Lamb, and these questions all have to do with
Galactus.
Oh, of course they do.
This is actually part one. There will be another Galactus quiz if you'll have me back.
Galactus quiz.
All right, lay it on us.
Because I kind of went Galactus.
We're gonna learn.
I started going. So this is really easy. So it really comes. It's more like rapid fire. Like who can raise their hand fastest? Because these are really basic Galactus questions.
All right, Chris and Cole, get your hands ready. I'm gonna sit back.
Oh, come on, Ben.
Let's go. Bring it.
All right. What was Galactus's first appearance in?
Oh, no, actually,
what
I
issue?
Do not know that.
Both Chris and Cole lifted their hands up quickly, but then lowered them.
It's not number 48, is it?
Of what title?
Fantastic Four.
Correct.
Hey, job, ding, ding, ding.
I was going to say 52, but that didn't...
It's the same story arc.
Okay. Ish. So what planet did Galactus first visit? Was it Earth, Zenla, or Clistron?
I'm gonna say Earth.
Nope.
Nah.
Zenla.
Yep. Bonus question, who lived on that planet?
Norrin Rad.
Yep.
The Silver Surfer.
Yep.
Ah. Did he just ruin one of your other trivia questions?
No, because see, what happens is when I started looking up all these questions, I found more questions. The questions.
Okay. She had backups.
So there'll be other ones where I have like three or four bonus questions.
Listeners should know how giddy she is right now.
You can probably tell because I'm talking like this up really fast. I'm so excited.
Her shoulders are up around her ears right now.
All
right,
question number three.
Question number three. What is the name of Galactus's daughter? It's a little trickster.
Whoa.
Go ahead.
Galactica? No.
Nah. Battlestar?
No.
I didn't even know that he had a daughter. Well,
I'm mispronouncing it.
Yeah.
Galactica. But
you put in an extra syllable.
Oh, Galacta.
Galacta?
Yes.
Galacta. Okay, there we go. Yeah.
When
I was a kid, I always pronounced them Galacticus. Yeah. So I guess my part, something in the back of my head is just like, keep going. It must be his daughter.
Is she a giant person too?
She is, and she loves to eat a lot.
She loves to eat. She calculates all of her calories. Yeah. And
is she a parodic character or is she a for reals character?
She's a real character, but no one really uses her.
Not really.
She's kind of a joke background character.
But when you start bringing the calorie concerns in there.
Next question.
All right, question number four.
Okay, what is Galactus's most known power? Oh, Ben.
Can he eat planets? Is that his most known power?
No.
Oh, I'm trying here.
Thank you, Ben. Chris.
Is it the power cosmic?
It is.
Yes.
I was going to say cosmic awareness.
Yeah, that's up there. That's part of it.
All right, so the last question, I had to actually roll like a 10-sided die to pick which ones I was going to do.
Nice.
Because I wanted to do them all.
Nice.
Okay. What was the weapon used to stop Galactus from destroying
Chris
Earth?
Had a 10 at first, but Cole is so excited.
Cole, how about we
just say it at the same
time. The ultimate nullifier.
Great job, guys.
And they high five. All right.
It's a win.
Thanks, Nicole, for those questions. Thank you for listening. You can find us every week here at perfectaboundpodcast.com. You can email us, perfectaboundpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find everything Nicole Hornaday and I, Ben Lawrence, do at thepaneljumper.com. All these .coms, I'm getting .commed out. You can buy any comic your little heart desires here at Comics Dungeon, 319 Northeast 45th Street. Or you can go to comicsdungeon.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's it for us. We will see you next week.